This is the RightsCast Network at rightscast.net. This is episode 20 of Novel Approaches here on the RightsCast Network. Welcome to the RightsCast Network's Novel Approaches podcast, a craft-focused conversation for writers everywhere.
Because writing novels is hard, and we're all in this together.
Hey there, I'm author, writing coach, and guy who does not like snow on Halloween, R.R. Campbell.
And I'm Sione Ashleman, freelance editor, coffee addict, and co-host of the Novel Approaches podcast.
In this installment of Novel Approaches, we'll be taking a look at crafting villains. But first, Sione, what's new in your world?
Well, our listeners will know I came back from vacation. Oh my God, that was like a month ago.
Doesn't feel like it, does it?
That feels like mere days ago. I've just been very busy since then. This month I did the YA for YA. We just had the announcements. I'm very excited to work with the author I chose, Zora Ask, on her manuscript, Georgia Winters and the Golden Goddess. There are so many reasons I'm excited. I will tweet more about it, but I won't go into it here. And I've been working a little bit on the anthology project that I keep hinting at that I'm very excited about, and it's going to gear up next, starting in January, I think. And with editing work, of course, and I don't know, I just, like, this last month has made me realize that I need to change how I approach work, which brings me to something that you and I have talked about and that I want to let our listeners know. I've decided to take a little break from the podcast while I regroup and figure out how I want to move forward. So I'm doing that kind of, you know, I feel very torn. On the one hand, I'm very much looking forward to having some time to really think through how I want to do life, basically, in a way that feels sustainable. But also, I will miss this, and I will miss you.
I very much agree. You know, I think that we've been building something really great here, and I will be sad to, you know, not have you every month as part of this conversation. But knowing what you are working on, knowing all of the plates that you're keeping spinning in the air, et cetera, I think this is a good choice for you. And I applaud you for taking the step to kind of like reset and figure out exactly what it is that you are able to embrace and what right now maybe be outside the scope of the hug of work, if we're going to stick with the word embrace.
The hug of work, I like it. Yeah. Thank you. I really appreciate your support.
And it's, like I said, I mean, we're certainly going to miss you. And I know listeners might be wondering at this juncture, well, what happens now, right? Am I going to have to listen to R.R. Campbell ramble at me for an hour every month beyond his author interviews for the other shows? And the answer to that is no. In fact, I'm actually really excited now to kind of take advantage of this opportunity to some extent to really get listeners even more involved in the show. And that is where we are going to be introducing guest co-hosts. So if you are listening to this show, if you are someone who has participated in our RightsCast chats in the past, if you're someone who's sent me an email or commented on one of our tweets or whatever the case might be, we would like to have you on the show, possibly, as a guest co-host. And so the way this is going to work, Sione, your last episode before your break is going to be December of this year, and then starting in 2020... we are going to be bringing on guest co-hosts. And if you would like to apply to become a guest co-host, if you would like to chat about a particular topic in the world of writing with me over the course of an hour, like Sione and I do now, just head to rightscast.net/novelguest. That's rightscast.net/novelguest. You can just answer a few questions over there. And then if I think we're a good fit and subject to, you know, availability, this is only a limited run of episodes, of course. But yeah, if it all works out, you can sit across from me, so to speak, on our Skype chat, and we can have it out about whatever it is the listeners have chosen for us to talk about for that month. So excited to bring you on, excited to meet the people who participate in these RightsCast chats. And all the while, I'll be happy to have listeners on, but I'll be looking forward to Sione coming back as well. So we're going to be, big, fun, exciting transitions here for everyone. I think this is going to be a fun experiment. So again, that's rightscast.net/novelguest. And you can just head to the rightscast.net homepage and I'll have some info there as well.
I think that'll be really great. And I'm looking forward to listening to those episodes too. And there are a couple people I can think of in particular. I won't name any names who have participated in the chats. And I would love to see guests on your show. So.
Yes, and I would agree. There are definitely some folks that I have my fingers crossed will apply, but, so as not to bias the applicant pool, I will refrain from throwing any names out. But we'll have plenty of people who participated in that RightsCast chat in the conversation here. But before we get to the conversation about crafting villains, we, of course, have to award the critique winner for this month.
Yep.
For those of you who do not know, those who support the RightsCast Network over on Patreon get entered in this monthly drawing for a critique of their first five pages. And this month's winner is Kristen Oakley, who is a longtime wise mentor to the podcast as well. So, Kristen, I will be in touch. It's my month to provide the five-page critique, and keep an eye out for that email. And we can
congratulations. Connect.
Congratulations, of course, as well. So, there you have it. We've got our announcements taken care of. We've got our critique winner drawn. It is time, Sione, it is time to talk crafting villains. So we had a good RightsCast chat about this, and it looks like you had a note here that, of course, we should start with definitions. Why didn't I think we should start with definitions? So do you have any thoughts on what a villain is and how a villain might differ from an antagonist?
Yeah, well, I actually had, as usual with these conversations, I go in being much more sure than I leave them. So I went in with like this very clear sense for me that there were a couple differences. A villain needs to be a person, where an antagonist doesn't need to be a person. So, for example, the antagonist of the story could be a natural disaster, or in the movie Children of Men, one might say that the antagonist is infertility, things like that. But a villain, it seemed very clear to me, must be a person. On this first point, in preparation for recording this episode, I went online and just, looked at people's lists of like best villains ever or whatever. And somebody actually mentioned, I stole it, I didn't make that up, Infertility for Children of Men as one of their favorite villains, which I was like, oh, okay. That's interesting. And then the other thing that I thought would make a difference is that a villain needs to be someone other than the protagonist. Whereas sometimes the protagonist, I would say maybe especially in literary fiction, the protagonist is also the antagonist. Like, they are their own obstacle. They are their own worst enemy. But I think it was Sina said that, for him anyway, the villain could also be the protagonist. So, yes. So I thought that was good food for thought. I'm actually, I put this on here mainly, though, now that I babbled about it, because I'm really interested in your perspective on it. And, like, how do you define a villain? And does a villain have to have, like, evil intentions? Is that what makes, like, is that what makes them villainous, right? Or is there even a difference? I don't know. I'm curious.
Well, what I like about the definitions you've laid out is, there is a really nice line that's been drawn here between a villain and an antagonist. And though you said, of course, you found online there was somewhere that was talking about infertility as a villain as opposed to an antagonist. I kind of like the idea of separating the two and perhaps not even only thinking about villains as, a person, but any character with agency or any sort of, entity that has agency that's going to be taking concrete actions to impede the progress of our protagonist, that starts to feel a little bit more villainous. And then that kind of gets me thinking about, you ask the question whether or not the villain has to be evil, and that is what creates villainy and leads to villains. And I think that that's true, though, as I suspect will become the case over the course of this conversation, there's going to be more nuance to that as well. Because if we are to create villains who are not simply bad for the sake of being bad, they, to themselves, and perhaps to a subset of readers, are not necessarily evil. They just have goals that are not in alignment with the protagonist, and so relative to the protagonist's worldview, they are, to some extent, villainous. And again, even as I'm saying that, I know there's some weird shades in here and some strange overlap I can't quite put my finger on, but maybe it'll become more apparent as we chat.
Well, and what you just said about, whether they're bad for, if you want to create a villain who's not just bad, like evil for evil's sake, which I think you and I agree, we both tend to not really like that type of villain. But I came across another article that was talking about their favorite Disney villains. And one of the things they liked best about Disney villains, the best Disney villains, is in their perspective, they just were evil for evil's sake, which made them scarier because it's not something you could reason them out of. And personally, I find it difficult that I don't find them believable when that is the case. Not that, like, anybody accused Disney of being, like, having particularly believable villains. But, I thought that was an interesting point that makes me think maybe I'm more into antagonists than I am villains. And maybe that is a key difference, that villains are evil and antagonists can have really noble motives and goals and just terrible ways of trying to get there, or ways that we disagree with, we the readers, and who the heroes disagree with too.
I really do like all that you've laid out there, and I'm wondering too whether or not the target audience has some effect in the way that we choose to, or to what extent we choose to roll with your mustache-twirling, evil for the sake of being evil villain versus an antagonist that has some of these shades of nuance. You think about Disney movies and who the target audience would have been, or presumably would have been, when they are first released, and oftentimes I think that it's meant to be accessible to a younger audience who at times might not always be able to appreciate some of the nuances that go into the motivations. Like you say, there might be an antagonist with noble motivations, but they have a bad strategy, or they have noble motivations, but they just don't happen to sync up with the protagonist we empathize with more. So I'm guessing that that is going to play a role in all of this as we kind of go through the conversation as well.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a good point. I mean, I've read something about human development where one's brain is actually pretty stuck in black and white thinking for until early to mid 20s, until it finishes developing basically like when you're 26 or whatever. That's a huge generalization. But you're saying that, and I'm also thinking about, like, other things that I watched as a kid for kids where there was more nuance and that I thought was actually much richer. So then I have to wonder, to what extent are we actually perpetuating this black and white mentality by having villains like Disney villains? I know that's getting kind of philosophical and cultural, but
and if
that's
we want to if we want to take it a step further, I would make the argument that one of the reasons we might be seeing that continue to be part of the media landscape is because the vehicles that are delivering these kinds of villains exist for what reason? Profit. And it becomes a broader indictment of something like capitalism that is only furthering this notion that we must have clear lines between good and evil. And there's also, brand entrenchment with something like Disney. You come to expect a certain kind of protagonist, antagonist, or hero villain dynamic. And that those stories being popular just continues to dig folks deeper into the trench that we've been in since Walt first decided he was going to create Steamboat Willie. So You know, I don't know. I'm not here to take pot shots at Disney, but just a thought I had as you were mentioning that.
Well, and then you say that, and now I'm thinking about one of the examples that this person gave in their blog post about good villains was the next door neighbor kid in Toy Story.
Oh, yeah.
Who just sort of revels in meanness. But then I think about Toy Story 3, which takes place at that daycare. And, like, all those toddlers, they don't revel in meanness. They don't mean to be mean to the kit, to the toys. They just don't know any better. Like, this to them is playing. And in fact, one might argue that they're just exercising out-of-the-box creativity by, like, you know, taking dolls' heads off and replacing them with other things, things like that.
Right. And I think that there is, if we bring this back to, we were talking about, you know, how the brain forms and, you know, it's not until 26 or so that you actually are in a position to maybe fully embrace or understand these shades that exist in between the black and the white. At the same time, you know, a movie like Toy Story 3 could be easily viewed by that younger audience, and whether they're actually processing what's being communicated there or not in a very overt way, it's still there. So it's never the case that we grow up for the first 25 years of our life and we only see black and white villains, and then suddenly a switch flips and we're exposed to all this media that is of the other camp. There is this sort of gradation that I think people get introduced to, and depending on the media that you consume and depending on the kinds of media that you are generally attracted to as a result of that, that probably has some effect on what it is you're looking for in a villain and how it is that you understand villainy and antagonism in the first place.
Yeah. We're going to move on, but this conversation is making me want to go back and rewatch Toy Story 3. Because now my mind is a little bit blown by actually how sophisticated it might be.
Pixar, you know, it's Disney / Pixar, and Pixar's always doing something a little extra, I guess. But to your point, let's hop into the crafty side of this now. We've got our definitions laid out and some broader philosophical underpinnings and things to mull over. Why don't we talk about how it is that we get to know the villains in our stories and how it is that we can make them resonate more with readers? I think you've got a tweet here to kick us off.
Yeah. So the first one is from our good friend Sina, who tweets at CINAEDHVIK. And Sina said, "I like to make the villain the one in the right. I start with the villain as a misunderstood entity and then get the hero's POV as someone who does not get it and yet opposes it, because the real villain will turn out to be the hero's misconceptions." I thought this was a super interesting way to look at it. I think it could create a really interesting type of villain. Maybe not work in every single case, but I really like in particular the idea that it's that whoever the hero identifies as the villain, in the end it turns out that it's actually the hero's misunderstanding that has created that perception. That's what I got out of that. How about you?
What I really like about Sina's comments here is that it creates this, for me anyway, from a bird's eye view. I'm seeing that this would lead to a manuscript and eventually to a novel where theme becomes really impactful, because if we are on the same journey as the protagonist, we are going to be walked down this road where we suddenly are built up to have a preconceived notion or idea about this villain. And when we suddenly realize that our own misconceptions were getting in our way through really understanding maybe that villain or what it is they stood for, their motivations or what have you, I think that could create a book that has a particularly resonant theme. And I know that theme is often a really difficult thing to wrap one's mind around. I know that we did that whole episode with John Adamus, you know, in 2018 at some point, talking about theme, and it was a really tough one to pin down. But I think that this kind of story, using something like this, would be a really effective way to, whether we understand how to define theme or not, to deliver a theme that is, like I said, really resonant.
Yeah, that's an interesting point.
And on the point of empathy, we're talking in Cinna's example, of course, about empathizing with the protagonist, who it turns out both we and the protagonist had some misconceptions. We had a contribution here in the RightsCast chat from Kim as well. Kim tweets at everyone's favorite Lechego My Ego. That is LechegoMyEgo. And Kim had this to say on empathy. A villain you can empathize with and see yourself in is probably one of the scariest or most unsettling. And then Kim added in a later tweet, I need to know enough to be as emotionally invested in the villain losing as I am in the main character winning. And what I really liked about this is, again, we're seeing this interesting contrast, right? Where we could, in Cinna's case, we're with the protagonist and it turns out the villain, the antagonist, was our misconceptions all along. But then if we're on the other side of that coin, and maybe it's not even a coin at all, maybe it's just a continuum that we can exist in a few different spaces on, if we empathize strongly with the villain because we can see a lot of ourselves in them and that becomes very unsettling, that kind of has the opposite effect where rather than at the end we go, oh man, this person I was cheering for all along was maybe actually to some extent villainous. Now we're with this person from the start who's a villain and we go, oh no, I really see myself in them. We fret. And then we get to the end of the book. And depending on how resolution is reached between the antagonizing and protagonizing forces, we then also leave that book with a different sense of identity, and possibly that's delivered to us again through something more thematic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, this goes a little bit back to what I sort of touched on earlier about one of my favorite types of villains is the type that they actually have an end goal that I agree with and that I really want to see happen, but the way they go about it is horrific. And the example that I gave in the Twitter chat was Admiral Duarte in the Expanse series books. It's it was book 7 or 8. I'm really not sure where I'm at right now. There's a lot of books. They're still coming. Persepolis, I think, was the last one that I watched. And so that's the one I'm thinking of that I read. And that's the one I'm thinking of in particular. Also a TV show, but they haven't gotten that far. I don't want to give any spoilers, but he is that type of villain. Like, I see what he's going for. And he feels bad about what he thinks he has to do to make this happen. And he's kind of one of those guys that rationalizes his behavior by saying, if I don't kill these few people now, a lot more people are going to die in the long run. You know what I mean? So there's a lot that I'm like, okay, I'm really empathizing with him. And then thank God Holden is there to like provide me with an anchor, because I'm one of those people who's really good at empathizing and getting lost in other people's perspectives and and going down that road. And like, yeah. So thank God Holden is there to say, yes, and
right.
This is not okay. There's another way to do it. Like, yeah. And it's never okay to become basically the dictator, the evil dictator, in order to get things done. I've simplified it a lot, but yeah.
Well, you know, you want to avoid spoilers, like you say. And as you were describing the situation that Admiral Duarte finds themselves in, where there is this idea of, well, you know, what is it that I need to do versus the number of lives that could be lost doing it? It reminds me of this dialogue that I've had with a couple of readers, actually, about Imminent Dawn, the first book in my empathy series, where there is the, you know, we have this ruthless tech magnate who's one of our perspective characters, Wyatt. He finds this study that is his life's work being compromised by unexpected circumstances, and he has to, at several points, make these really critical decisions about whether the research goes forward, knowing what that entails in terms of risks to study participants, or if he has to pull the plug. And so you find this character who I'm not going to say how I feel about him as the author, but there are these two camps, right? There is this camp that is team Wyatt did nothing wrong because he was doing what it is that he set out to do. And the people that signed up for this study knew what they were getting into, quote unquote. And then there's other people who see Wyatt as this absolutely untrustworthy schmuck who should have never been put in this position in the first place. And look at all the horrible things that are happening on his watch. And so I think that's a really great example of someone who is clearly an antagonist to many, but also to those maybe in his community within this speculative world. He's very much a protagonist because of what it is he has set out to do. So here we are again, seeing that there can be a little column A, a little column B going on here.
Well, and along the lines of another way to create empathy is Jessica's tweet. Jessica tweets at JessicaBlueWRI1. And Jessica said that she really likes Damon from The Vampire Diaries. Now, she's talking about the TV show and not the book there. But she likes him because he occasionally saves a life, saves the day, despite himself. Also, he is unapologetically himself. And so what I get from that is not only does he's a villain, but he ends up doing like good things. Not only that, but when I read he's unapologetically himself, this is a quality that I see in characters sometimes that I really admire. And so that he actually has this admirable trait, like he owns who he is and doesn't try to like be anybody different. When I was reading that, I was thinking about this Tor.com article that ended up in my email inbox today about criminals who saved the day. There was like a article about five books where criminals saved the day. And that I think Damon would be, maybe he's not a criminal per se because he's a vampire and anyway, but yeah, he's maybe an example of this kind of character. And then that led me to further think about a TV show that I really like, which is Peaky Blinders. It's a period piece that takes place post World War I during Prohibition era. And the protagonists are these brothers who are had who fought in the war and came back, and because things in England are so depressed, the way that they found to make money is by running a crime ring, basically. They like have bars and casinos and things like that. And there's never, like, and they do horrible, horrible things, but they're not as bad as some of the other criminals. And so, right, so that just, I don't know where I'm going with that, except, like, there's this whole, like, layers upon layers of, having empathy, just for, even though the Peaky Blinders gang are, they do, like, really terrible things that I disagree with in real life. Also, I have a lot of empathy for them because I know their backstory and because I know that they do things better than some of these other characters.
I really like the idea that in this case, then, villainy or antagonism becomes sort of relative. You mentioned Peaky Blinders, but that also makes me think about shows like Boardwalk Empire, which takes place in New Jersey, Prohibition era. And you have, a guy who is a bit of a ringleader for the local booze-running cartel. And then there's plenty of people, though, who are up to far worse than him. He certainly doesn't have his hands clean either. But yeah, you've got that show. You've got something like Deadwood is another one where, boy, that you are sometimes empathizing with the owner of that bar. God, Al Swearengen, terrible, terrible man. But there are some people who are way worse relative to the world that we are given to watch. So it puts you in a really tricky spot as a viewer in this case, or as a reader if you are picking these kinds of stories up. But it does certainly say something about how when we're telling these stories, evil or villainy can be sort of relative to the story we're trying to tell.
Well, and I also think another important common point in the examples that you and I both chose is that the bad guy's not bad all the time. And I think that's what's key in Jessica's tweet about Damon, is that maybe we totally disagree with their philosophy on life, their methods, their goal, whatever it is, but not all the time. And that's part of what makes them, in my view, so, I don't know, just like satisfying as characters. The villains that are just all bad all the time, I just have a really hard time getting as invested in that.
Did you know the RightsCast Network is listener-supported? That's right, listeners just like you choose to support our programming financially through contributions of $1, $2, or $3 per episode or per month. In exchange for their support, RightsCast Network patrons can receive awesome rewards, including early, ad-free access to every episode of our programming, RightsCast Network swag, discounts on my editing services, shoutouts in our shows, and more. Not only that, but the contributions of RightsCast Network patrons have us painfully close to unlocking a fourth podcast every month. Sound like something you're interested in? Help us bring you more content every month by visiting patreon.com/rightscast and becoming a supporter today. That's patreon.com/rightscast. Thanks for listening. And I think that might be because, as you say, these characters that have this, these moments where we can see there is some good in them, it just makes them more compelling. But on your note about characters who are bad just to be bad, or they're evil just to be evil, that is a question that we posed to people during our RightsCast chat. And it kind of centered around this. It was villains who are caricatures of villainy. How do we feel about that? And how can we avoid it if we feel it's something that needs to be avoided? And we had a tweet here from Kim, and Kim had this to say, "Mustache twirly villains are my big no. When a villain exists only to be bad, they're not only boring, but pose no real threat in the course of a story." And I think that, kind of like what you said there, sometimes it's just really hard to rally around or to buy into a story as much when there is a villain who just exists only to be evil. I kind of agree with a lot of that sentiment. I think the one thing that I would maybe contest is that they pose no real threat in the course of a story. I think that there is an angle of that where we might say, okay, yeah, they don't pose a threat in that if we have a character who's a caricature of villainy, odds are this is going to be a classic, you know, white hat versus black hat story. The white hats prevail. And so we read the entire book going, yeah, you know, we kind of see where this is going. But that's not to say that the villain can't have plenty of victories along the way and at least, you know, give the white hats a run for their money. But otherwise, I kind of agree. I've never been a big fan of opening a book or watching a show where it's like, oh, yeah, here's our bad guy. They're just bad now. Cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I think about that tweet, and especially, I just love that phrase, mustache twirly villains. I think about the type of villain, probably in cartoons mostly, where their sole purpose or goal is to mess up whatever the protagonist is trying to do. And so that's where I think that they're boring and don't really pose a threat. That's where I could see that they could be perceived as not really posing a threat, because what they're trying to do is just, you know, stop Chip and Dale from getting nuts or something. And like, while that's important to Chip and Dale, it's not like the world is going to explode or something like that. And so that's kind of where I go with that. But also, it made me, when you were talking, it made me think about the original Care Bears series and movies, because I'm that old.
Hey, I remember the Care Bears. They were around.
Yeah, so, well, you're almost as old as I am. I hate to break it to you.
It's true.
Yeah. But so, Professor Coldheart, do you remember him?
Well, vaguely.
Oh my gosh. You have got to re-watch Care Bears in the Land Without Feeling, because I had totally forgotten, and I think you can see it on YouTube, but I'd forgotten Professor Coldheart introduces himself with a rap. He raps about himself.
Whoa.
Yes. It's incredibly surprising and disturbing and funny all at the same time. But here's my point. Professor Coldheart, when he's first introduced, I think in The Land Without Feeling, that's the first time he's introduced, he has a goal that has nothing to do with the Care Bears. He is trying to take feeling out of everybody because feelings cause problems. They're really uncomfortable. And so it's just better to like not feel feelings. And so he's got his freeze ray gun that he's just trying to make the whole world. And he's sort of like sucking the souls out of kids a little bit. and so the Care Bears are trying to stop him for obvious reasons. They're the good ones. So that's the first time he's introduced. And what I like about that is that he has a goal that's not about just doing something contrary to what the Care Bears want, right? He has his own agenda, and that comes into conflict with the Care Bears' agenda. However, as the series progressed, and especially in like the couple of episodes of the new Care Bears series that I saw, unfortunately, he becomes one of those mustache twirly villains. Like, he's so mad that they stopped him from creating a land. They stopped him from creating a land without feeling. That now his whole agenda is to just like mess with the Care Bears. And that's where he becomes one of these villains that Kim is warning us about.
Right. It seems that he went soft in his old age. You know, he held a vendetta and he only wanted to take it out against the Care Bears. And as you're talking about this, it also made me think of another cartoon, and that is the Smurfs. You remember there was Gargamel, of course. Yeah. And as you were talking about the Care Bears here, I was like, did Gargamel have a deeper agenda, or was he just trying to get the Smurfs? And I was like, I'm going to look this up. So, of course, I did. And it turns out that Gargamel, though I have a memory of him being just like kind of bad and he just wanted to get the Smurfs, it turns out that in Smurf lore, Gargamel wanted to get the Smurfs because he needed them to turn base metal into gold. For like alchemy.
He was an alchemist.
Yeah, look at that. Yes. And see, these are things that like when I was really young and watching the show, I was just like, oh yeah, I don't want Gargamel to get the Smurfs, whatever. But here we are. I mean, and it's hitting again on exactly what Kim has said and what you're saying here is that when we have these villains who aren't just bad, they don't exist only to stop whatever the main character is doing. They become, you know, they're not these mustache twirling villains. They have a little bit more depth as long as they have an ethos driving what it is that their decision making, how their decision making manifests on the page or on the screen. Cool. I mean, it just seems like they become a little more memorable and they become a little more real, I would say.
Plus, Gargamel had a cat, Azrael.
Yeah.
And all pet lovers everywhere have to like Gargamel a little bit better. Because he had a feline companion. You know who else had cats? The villain whose name I don't even remember from Inspector Gadget.
Oh, he did. Yeah.
Yeah, he had a cat.
I can see the
although
cat.
Although, he also had a robotic hand.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. There was something else going on there. And then, Dr. Evil.
Dr. Evil.
Which brings me to Cinna's comment, because Cinna is providing a nice little devil's advocate argument against what we've been talking about. Cinna said that Dr. Evil in Austin Powers is great as a parody of this type, but I can't find the real thing very entertaining. He goes on to say, evil guy is evil. And does evil because he's evil and loves evil. We talked about that a little bit. I'm not a fan of that either. He said, I need at least a little empathy with the villain and their goals and system of logic to believe in them as a person. So a couple of things here. First of all, Cinna mostly agrees with what we've been saying. And also I thought his point about it depends on the genre in which you're writing, because if you're writing a parody or a satire, then you might actually want the villain who is evil and does evil because he's evil and loves evil.
And I'm glad you mentioned genre here, because though we have been kind of teasing at it and touching on it here and there, there is this genre expectation in something like writing parody. But also one thing that has been kind of in the forefront for me more recently is also that there are genres like Westerns, for example, where there's a good guy And there's a bad guy. And I actually have been starting to get some feedback on that Slickshot Abbey manuscript where, you know, yeah, the cowboys and the dinosaurs for listeners who are unfamiliar. Yeah. And so one of the questions I had for beta readers was, how do you feel about the emotional resonance of this manuscript? Does it have, you know, an emotional core? Does it need one? How can you see it being emphasized differently here and there? And the most recent beta reader to get back to me talked about how it's really okay to leave it as you have it mostly because you're working in a genre where more often than not, you're going to have good guys and you're going to have bad guys and there's very little in between. People who come to these kinds of books have an expectation that it's just about the action and the narrow escapes and just watching the hero save the day at the end. And so that's okay. They mentioned there might be one little spot you could punch up the emotional resonance or one little plot thread to thicken, so to speak. But I thought that was a really great point they made because, yeah, there are some genres, particularly in Westerns, that, yeah, I think you're just going to see the good guy be good. The bad guy is bad. And that's just kind of what folks are looking for, I guess.
I feel you're saying, wait, you mentioned Deadwood earlier, which was something that also occurred to me when prepping for this episode. And Timothy Oliphant's character is obviously the good guy, but I'm trying to remember if he ever did. Was he always just the good guy? Did he ever do anything we disagreed with?
Which character did that actor play? I can't remember.
Timothy Oliphant is the sheriff. He's the main person. He's the main character.
Oh yeah, he's Seth Bullock, right? Okay.
Even in Deadwood, which of all the things of all the westerns where I would expect that the good guy would also do bad things, I don't think he did. Like, the worst thing he did was not end up with the woman he was in love with because his honor was too strong and he married his brother's wife to keep her and the kids safe. And I was like, I didn't like him for that. But also, if that's the worst thing you're going to do, like, you're right. Westerns. That's a good example.
And we also asked folks in our RightsCast chat, of course, what their number one tip for crafting villains happened to be. And Cinna said that it all kind of boiled down to this for him. Villains are people too, Cinna says. They have hopes and fears and dreams and favorite foods and all the rest. And a villain you can understand, if not agree with, makes them so much more compelling. And I think that is a really good distillation of kind of the direction this conversation has gone. And that is that it all comes down to making them feel like a real person. I know I used the word humanize a little earlier, and maybe there's a risk that we run in humanizing some types of villainy. But even that said, I think just making them three-dimensional and thinking about them as people who, as Cinna says, have these favorite foods, etc., can just make them feel more real and therefore more compelling.
Mm-hmm. And just to add to that is Jessica's tweet, Jessica Blue Rye 1, said, I try to make sure they want something very badly as well, which guides them in making the decisions they do. I think that's really important that the villain has a very clear goal. And I would add personally to it, then this is, you know, kind of wrapping both of these tweets up together, that motives and stakes are super important to me for believable, compelling villains. Not just that they want something and we know what it is they want, but also why they want it and what they feel they have to gain or lose by getting or not getting that thing that they want.
And in a sense, then, we are treating our antagonists, we're treating our villains from a storytelling standpoint very similar to how we want to have an understanding of our protagonists. We need to know about their motivations. We need to know what their wager or their stakes are going to be. And so, again, you know, the antagonist or the villain is just as important in many cases as the protagonist is, as our main character is. So let's make sure we give them their due, right?
Well, and I think what's coming up for me right now, I don't know why this of all things, but the TV show Tin Star, have you seen that one?
You have mentioned that in past episodes, but I have not had a chance to check that out.
That's right. not everyone binge watches TV like I do. Some people have a life.
It's a broad media landscape, you know? There's many shows that... a show I didn't even bring up in this entire episode is Succession, but I don't want to interrupt your thread, so please...
We'll come back to Succession because I haven't heard of that one. But Tin Star is one of these where, I just thought of it now, so my brain's kind of exploding with ideas about it. But in the context of this conversation, the villain is some unknown person who murdered the protagonist's kid. I'm not giving anything away. That happens in like the first 5 minutes of the show. Okay. Because they are really good at getting right to the action. It's one of these like 8-episode. It's like a Amazon Prime.
Like a mini series
show or something like that. Yeah. I think it has 2 seasons now, but anyway, so the villain is somebody who kills a toddler. Now, granted, they were aiming for the protagonist, but they still killed the toddler. And then the protagonist, played by, oh my God, what is his name? I love him. He's British. That's not helpful. Tim Roth. Is that a person?
That might be Tim a person. Roth. I'm miserable with the names of actors, etc., as evidenced by my Timothy Oliphant gaffe.
I'm like, is that a person? I'm pretty sure that's his name. I could be getting something mixed up. But Tim Roth, whom I love as an actor, he's been in a lot of wonderful things. But he plays the protagonist. And so what I like about this sort of villain thing that happens in this show, and this is where I'm going to try to stay away from spoilers, but because you learn more about where the protagonist, where Tim Roth's character, his backstory, where he came from, a lot of season one is, about half of season one is actually flashback, which is hard to do well in a story, but I think they do it well here. So where you learn more about like where he's come from and where he's been, and you also learn more, you come to find out about why the villain did what he did too. And then there's a little bit of a switch that happens. And so the outcome that you're rooting for, you're not really sure that you're rooting for anymore at the end. That's all I can really say without giving too much away. But I really like how they did that. They actually, as you said, humanized the villain. They created enough empathy that even if totally disagree with what they did and don't think they should be, you know, running around unsupervised, as it were, you also see the potential for redemption in them. And the protagonist, who you were totally on board with at the beginning, becomes less and less likable for various reasons that I will not divulge.
I think
a little bit villainous.
Right. That creates a really interesting, I can just kind of visualize. It's difficult to describe, but I'm thinking about it visually, where you just kind of see, you know, the literal role reversal or like a perception reversal. And that seems like a really interesting and, of course, very deliberate storytelling choice. I mean, it seems like that is what is meant to make that as a series compelling in the first place. It's what makes it memorable. And to kind of transition into the thought that I had about a show like Succession, which is the second season of it wrapped up not that long ago over on HBO. And for those who aren't familiar with Succession, it's basically what the title says it is about. It takes place, it follows this family that is part of an international media empire, and the old man who started the company and who turned it into this extraordinary conglomerate. I mean, they're rich out of their minds, but like it's very apparent that his health is slowly failing him, and one of his kids has to take over the company, right? And for a long time when I saw the ads for this show, I was like, oh my God, that show looks so awful and greasy, and who wants to watch these rich snobs just duke it out over something like a media empire, etc. And then a friend said, no, man, I felt exactly the same way. And then I watched 4 episodes and everything changed. And basically what they do in that show is they take all of these characters who are just at their core, I mean, as people, they're just not good people. but they become likable to some extent as we watch them and get a better understanding of their personal journeys. And we start to see other characters willing to take another step and be additionally slimy. And suddenly we're like, well, in season one, you know, I didn't want any of these schmoes to take over as CEO, but now I really want Siobhan to take over as CEO. And now I'm not totally sold on her anymore either. Like, who really knows what's going on? So you develop this really interesting relationship to the characters and to the show. And it's one of those things that I started watching on my own, and my wife started watching a couple episodes with me. She also wasn't sold, and now it's turned into a show that I can't watch unless she's around, because we have to know what's going on at the same time. So character drama, having people be very 3D, having them with strong motivations and giving them good moments as well as bad can create this really nice, like I said, it's a character drama, and it's really great to follow for those reasons.
Yeah. Well, when you're talking about it, it sounds a little bit like a modern day Game of Thrones scenario, which makes me think about Game of Thrones and the villains in Game of Thrones. And one of the things that I thought they did well there is showed different characters having arcs that a couple characters in particular that they were villains to begin with, but you kind of change your mind about them as the show goes on. And anyway, that's one of the things I heard about Game of Thrones, is like you kept being pulled this way and that in terms of who you empathized with and who you wanted to be victorious.
And at the same time, they also had these villains. There was always one villain, at least, that was present who was just genuinely not going to be liked. You know, that was your King Joffrey. That was your Ramsay Bolton. And that actually ties in, I think, really nicely to the question that Cinna posed to us for our reader question out of our RightsCast chat. And Cinna had this to ask, I should say, how far is too far? I want to know what others think about the line between a believable villain and villain propaganda, right? So I guess maybe it doesn't tie exactly into your sort of Joffrey or your Ramsay Bolton, but I think it does tie into this idea that if we have these characters who are super evil or they do really terrible things, but we as readers or as viewers begin to empathize with them, or we're given moments where they are humanized, do we run a risk of almost making it seem like it's okay for these villains to have done these terrible and bad things? So that was an interesting question for me, and it is one that I'm not entirely sure I know how to answer. I could take some figurative, not literal, villainous stabs at it, but I don't know. Sion, do you have any thoughts on this before I try to tease this out?
I don't have any definitive thoughts. I think what comes up for me is that, in essence, this is the question of our age, which is, to what is it possible to take compassion too far? I think this is something that we're actually wrestling with on not just a national but a global level, in terms of fighting for social justice, and to what extent is it reasonable and desirable to empathize with, try to understand where people are coming from that you don't agree with, and to what extent is trying to understand viewed as maybe excusing the behaviors. I think it's a really important question. To what extent do we think that it's desirable to portray our villains as, and the really horrible things that they can do, as understandable? And it's what a lot of these shows that we've been talking about, these stories that we've been talking about, it's a lot of them get at that with Peaky Blinders, with Game of Thrones. It sounds like Succession gets into that a little bit. I think it's a really good question. I don't have an answer.
I think that this might be one of those questions that doesn't have an answer, but rather by virtue of the question existing, we can use that as our sort of guide as creatives who have to conjure and create these bad people who occasionally do good things or these good people who occasionally do bad things, and keep in mind that once this is out in the world, it's going to be examined through the context of the times. It's going to be examined through the context of a particular media cycle. It's going to be examined within the context of a particular day. And we do need, to some extent, be deliberate about how it is that we choose to portray any character, but of course, particularly villains, while at the same time trusting good faith readers and trusting the critical reader to be able to kind of tease out the true lessons and the true virtues we're trying to convey in a way that does not lead them down a path to believing there is an attempt being made to justify good people getting away with bad things, or bad people, because they do good things once in a while, being okay to embrace every last bit of them. It's strange because it requires a relationship between us as creators and people who consume that media that we will never meet. And so I think that is why it's difficult to answer that question concretely, but it is really informative, I think, and important to have that question in mind while we create, and especially while we revise and get the feedback from others in the earlier stages of a draft, perhaps.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that I keep talking about the Expanse series because that was what I had been reading most recently, but that's one of the things that I really appreciate about Persepolis, if I'm saying that right, or even remembering the name correctly, is that there is, like, one of the things that Holden is really good at is empathizing and seeing things from different perspectives. And he also has a very clear moral compass where it comes very easily to him to say, I get it, and absolutely not. So I think what you're, like, I agree with what you're saying. I think that's something that we should have in mind as creators when we're creating villains. And I also think that there's a lot of room for exploring what the answers might be through our characters, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's about being deliberate. It's about being additionally deliberate in having, like you say, there's this character who says, I get it, but, you know, and that can be enough to just instill within readers or consumers of that media that, okay, well, right, but okay, let's pump brakes a little bit on embracing toxic ideology number 4, for example.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, so that's one example of it, of exploring this question, like, how far is too far? What is that line between compassion and rationalization, basically, right? So Holden is one example of an answer to that question. But there are other possible examples as well. Like, you have other characters who have just, like, zero tolerance policy for any of that nonsense. And other characters who might have a really hard time, because they get lost in the empathy, they might have a really hard time holding on to their moral compass. And so those are just 3 examples, but there are a lot of opportunities for us in fiction to explore what happens when you take different approaches or different attitudes toward this question of how far is too far for being compassionate or trying to understand.
Right. And I think there are a lot of good takeaways in what you've said there. And I'm really glad that Cinna asked this question because it is an important one. And like you say, it's to some extent one of the great questions of our age. And so I think having kind of, let's leave that maybe where it rests and let that be part of an ongoing discussion, of course, that will happen not only on this podcast, but abroad, so to speak, as well. Let's talk maybe for a minute here about what our main takeaways are for the whole conversation. I don't know if anything stands out to you that resonated particularly strongly at every stage of this.
I'm my brain is boiling with all of the richness of our conversation. And as usual, I leave it feeling less certain than I did going in, which I think is a really good thing. Because that means that we've, you know, drawn out some different ideas here. I think Cinna's point about the genre is really well taken, something we've talked about in multiple episodes, that what you're doing depends a lot on the genre conventions. And all of that said, for me personally, still, I feel very strongly that villains are most compelling when I understand their goals, motives, and stakes, and that they're in it for something more than like just being bad.
Well, I have very little to add to any of that. That's really what's resonated with me as well. And I'm glad that you were able to sum it up succinctly there, because we are running up against that hour clock. So with that in mind, thank you, of course, Sion, for being here for this episode. Thank you to our RightsCast chat participants. We will, of course, have opportunities for further engagement for the December show. Listeners, you will be able to help us pick the topic for that one. We will put a poll up on Twitter over at RightsCast on Twitter. That'll go up after this episode debuts. We'll leave it there for a week, and you will be able to choose. You can vote between nonlinear storytelling as a possible topic, archetypes, tropes, and cliches as another possibility, new adult as an age category, or there will, of course, be a fourth option, and that is other. And you can vote for that, leave a comment, and we will, if it doesn't win, which other never has, you can still leave that comment down below. We will get that added to our rotation of possible future topics. And one day, we'll have ourselves in a position to vote on it. So again, you'll be able to choose between nonlinear storytelling, archetypes, tropes, and cliches, and new adult as an age category. And keep an eye out on Twitter and at rightscast.net for when that next RightsCast chat will be. And otherwise, I just want to thank you for joining us for this episode of Novel Approaches here on the RightsCast Network.
For more writerly podcast content like this, visit rightscast.net or follow us on Twitter at RightsCast. I'm also on Twitter at WriteLearnDream, and I'd love to connect with you.
I'm over on Twitter as IamRRCampbell. We mentioned this at the top of the hour, but we do have a Patreon page where folks can get really neat writerly perks like RightsCast Network swag. They can get discounts on my editing services, and of course they're entered in these monthly drawings for a first 5-page critique. You can contribute at $1, $2, or $3 per episode, or even just $1, $2, or $3 per month if that is better for you. So hey, why not start contributing to content you value, start contributing financially to conversations like these that we get to have every month. I know that you and I both get a lot out of these as the creators of the content, and I'm sure listeners do as well. So hey, if you want to say thank you, one way to do that is by showing your support at patreon.com/RightsCast.
We'd especially like to thank Laura Hazen, whose contributions at the Wise Mentor level earns her shoutouts in every RightsCast Network episode, on top of all the other great patron awards she receives.
So again, that's patreon.com/RightsCast, where you can become a patron today. Next up on the RightsCast Network, we've got an episode featuring sci-fi author Ryan DeCaria. Those of you who have been with the RightsCast Network going all the way back to 2016 will remember Ryan DeCaria from episode 18 of the show. He is now back for episode 70. Kind of hard to believe that it's been that long since he and I last chatted. And also, yeah, that there are that many episodes of that show. I think when you throw episode 70 there, this is our episode 20. We're coming up on 100 total episodes of content here. So exciting stuff. But November 15th, you can hear from Ryan DeCaria. Again, we were talking about how archetypes, tropes, and cliches play out specifically in the genre of sci-fi. So you can tune in at rightscast.net then, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Nice. Well, that's it for this episode of Novel Approaches. Thanks so much for listening.
Until next time, you know what to do. Write on and write well.
This is the RightsCast Network at rightscast.net.